sometimes have to step back. So I've been invited here to share my analysis on an event that unfolded between two of some of the world's largest institutions in the world, Google and China. Now, last summer in 2009, I was working at the China Internet Network Information Center, and that's located in Beijing, China. Now, CNIC is the equivalent to the FCC in the U.S. This worldwide drama between Google and China that I'll be telling you about actually began to unfold while I was doing ethnographic fieldwork with government policymakers, academics, youth, and migrants, and low-income users on technology use. Now, there were a few days spread out over the summer where I had lost access to all Google services that were once available in China. Gmail, documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoints, instant messaging, video chatting, RSS feeds, and more. So essentially, I lost access to my entire life. I kept hitting refresh and refresh over and over again into the dark nights, hoping my Gmail would come back. Now, CCTV, the government-sponsored television programming, was claiming that Google was a porn machine. I just really wanted to check my email. So for those of you who haven't been following the saga of Google and China, let me give you a quick refresher. So Google, most people are familiar with Google Search, right? It's a search engine. With over 1 billion servers around the world and 1 billion search requests a day, Google Search is the world's most popular internet search engine. Now, Google Search is available in over 40 different languages and is localized in over 180 countries. So for example, if we were to search for the word coneja, which is the Spanish word for bunny, on google.com and google.com.mx, the site for Spanish-speaking Mexico, you will get two different search results. I'm sorry, it keeps automatically switching, so I'll be going back and forth in the slides. I have no control over it for some reason. Okay, so as you can see, there's two very different search results for bunny, for coneja. So but whether or not you're in Mexico or the US, google.com or google.com.mx is always accessible. Now, however, Google.com isn't accessible in some countries, like in China. Yet tides changed in 2006 when China allowed Google to create a local version, Google.cn, under two main conditions. One, Google.cn would follow the information filtering rules that apply to all foreign internet companies operating in China. And two, Google.com would remain unblocked, would remain blocked. So now, even though Google.com's search service wasn't accessible in China, other Google services were, such as Gmail. That's why I could access it. But Chinese users who wanted to access Google.com had to continue using third-party servers. So however, this type of service is usually costly, and most Chinese netizens don't need to search on Google.com because they don't read English. Now, signs of discontent between Google and China began to surface in 2009, around the time I was researching in China. Sites that were once accessible, such as Gmail, were no longer reachable, and even local search, google.cn, was no longer available. Now, around January 2010, Google announced on its company blog that Chinese hackers had attacked the accounts of users who were involved in human rights. And Google said that the attacks originated in China. But China defended itself and was adamant that it held no relation or responsibility for the attacks. So Google stated it was no longer, quote, no longer willing to continue censoring our results. Now Google hinted at the possibility of closing Google.cn in China. Well, by March 2010, as you can see in this slide, Google negotiated a plan with the Chinese government that allowed them to move their servers off the mainland to Hong Kong, where its search services would remain unfiltered. So while google.com.hk was being created, google.cn was also shut down. Users mourned, leaving goodbye flowers at the main office in Google. Now, since Google first made their announcement in January 2010 of the attacks, countless news sites have praised Google for standing up to the Chinese and for standing up and reclaiming goodness. So these articles, along with Google, insinuate that if Google.cn hadn't been so censored, then Chinese people would have used it, and it would have been thus successful. But that simply wasn't the case. And I argue that Google wasn't being used because Google.cn wasn't useful. So for the first half of my talk, I will draw upon ethnographic research that I conducted in China among non-elite digital Chinese users to explain why Google was not useful overall. This sets me up to explain the cultural dimensions of information accessibility, which will help us understand why Google.cn was actually failed in China. In the second part of my talk, I will make the case that Google and the China saga is an example of a clash in moral orders, rendering the free information regime as a battle site of cultural imperialism. Information politics is ultimately a struggle over meaning and symbols. And then I get to the fun part, which is section 3, the macro commentating. I'm going to propose my theoretical position that the Google free information regime is an example of neo-informationalism, a retooling of neoliberal ideals and a re-envisioning of imperialism based on information as a commodity for the digital age. I will then close my talk with a reflection upon the role of humanities and social science researchers in the era of information politics. And can you tell me to slow down, because I'm trying to speed up for the sake of time, but let me know if I'm going too quickly. Now, to preface, I will generalize in order to make the point that there is a paradigm shift in information markets and that we should become attuned to these changes. This is not how I normally speak as an ethnographer of human interaction, especially in low-income communities, where their culture is usually not reflected in when you look at the ideologies of nation-states. However, nation-states and institutions are necessary, but not always sufficient analytical frameworks on their own, because we risk simplification and totalization. However, please bear with me during my talk, because I want to make the point that what we expect information to do matters. And I will engage in some harmless generalizing as long as we keep in mind that I'm not placing a value judgment on Google or China or trying to explain away the complexity of these institutions. It's also not my goal to do a Samuel Huntington redux of Clash of Civilizations, East meets West 2.0. So unlike Huntington, I do not believe that clashes are inevitable, but when they do happen, they are opportunities for us to examine the stories we tell about ourselves and others. And my goal for us is not to judge capitalism, imperialism, Google, or China, but for us to think about what knowledges and practices are emerging from these interactions so that we can be aware of possible outcomes and respond in such a way that minimizes conflict and maximizes understanding. So, part one. When Google announced their exodus from the mainland, many argued that this would be catastrophic for Chinese users. But on the basis of publicly available data and my own research, I wrote a post on my blog, Cultural Bytes, that suggests that Google's struggle in China has started long before attacks on its servers. And I argue that Chinese people weren't using Google not because Google.cm was filtered, but because they didn't find it useful. I argued that it wouldn't have been catastrophic because there weren't that many Chinese people using Google, and those who did were using .com instead of .cn. So while the security breach was out of Google's reach, I argue in my blog post that Google failed to execute on three main factors. One, achievement of brand recognition. Two, creating a successful marketing campaign. And three, understanding the local contexts of non-elite internet users. All factors that Google could have controlled. So starting with one, brand recognition. Google failed at this. They have not been successful at making their services relevant for the average Chinese internet user, nor have they made it easy for people to recognize, say, or even type their name in a keyboard. So many Chinese internet users do not even know how to get to the Google site. That's pretty surprising, right? So first of all, people didn't even know how to pronounce Google's name in Chinese, much less agree on the pronunciation. So Google never succeeded in having an immediately recognizable oral or visual name like Yahoo, Apple, or Microsoft. So for example, many people still call Google Go-Go, which means dog. So they will often type in the phonetic letters for Go-Go and land on a Google copycat with this dog, which is not Google. Or they will type in Google's name with one less O and they will end up at Google.cn, which is actually a phishing site. So phishing sites try to get you to enter in your password with the hopes of stealing your online information. So imagine this is like your first Google experience in China, so you're not very likely to return, right? So when Google created Google.cn, the censored version, it declared its Chinese name would be Guga, which means harvest song. In addition to the pastoral images connoted by harvest song, Guga could also be easily interpreted to mean grasshopper, groins, or shaving breasts. So users really, really hated the name. They actually started a petition for Google to change its name, creating a www.noguga.com to protest the name. Google didn't listen. So two, Google also didn't create a successful marketing campaign. Now, maybe Google thought people would just start using their products based on the word of mouth. And though people were familiar with Google, they just didn't want to use it because it's associated with being un-Chinese. Baidu is a homegrown reigning search engine in China with twice the market share of Google. Part of Baidu's success lays in the powerful symbolic marketing campaign against Google, using nationalism as one of the publicity strategies. And it's worked really well. The campaign is so effective that netizens associate the use of Google with being unpatriotic. So in this infamous Baidu commercial from 2006, Baidu wins an intelligence contest over its unnamed foreign competitor, Google, who is represented by this white male actor with the black hat. And Baidu succeeds in knowing more and the back and forth banter over the meaning of the scroll. The white man's Chinese female lover decides to leave him for the Chinese scholar who knows more about the scroll. Now, Baidu does an excellent job at tapping into nationalistic fervor, as we can see, as a superior search engine for China. Now, three, Google failed to understand local use context of non-elite users. Here's the thing. Solving the marketing problem and brand recognition is relatively simple when the bigger problem is that Google services are not useful. So the youth I spoke to across China just didn't see how any of the services offered by Google were easier to use than the ones that they were already using, such as Baidu. So here you can see Baidu offers really good MP3 music searches. Google doesn't. Quite simple. MP3 is in file format for digital music. Now, Chinese consumers really like to listen to music, and they want easy access to it. Music is one of the areas of the internet that is most free from censorship and most widely available in China. So it's a curiosity why Google didn't offer MP3 search, which I can talk to you about in the garden sessions. So who is using Google in China? Well, interestingly, the biggest fans of Google were Chinese academics, students, and business people age 18 and older, who I call the digital elite users. This group of digital users tended to be highly educated, and they were fluent in English language or owned a credit card. Some have been abroad or at least have a social network of international ties. And the digital elite, however, are such a small percentage of Chinese internet users that Baidu is still overwhelmingly the number one search service in China. But here's the thing. Even the digital elites weren't using google.cn. Rather, they were using third-party servers that sometimes required a fee paid through a credit card, which the digital elite users have, to access the otherwise blocked google.com and other Google services such as Google Scholar, Google Translation, and Gmail. So essentially, digital elites in China use Google for the same purposes as Western users. Highly educated Chinese users organize and prioritize information in ways that are much more similar to Western users than non-elite Chinese users. So Google has built an empire of services that work for Western contexts and values. So it's no surprise that their most loyal fans outside of the US are elite users who share similar class and occupational backgrounds with Western users. Now, I suggest that if Google wants to be more relevant in China, it should dedicate itself to understanding the Chinese market in a socio-anthropological way. They should be hiring teams of Chinese and non-Chinese ethnographers, sociologists, and anthropologists for long-term collaboration in all phases of research and design with human-computer interaction designers, user interface experts, programmers, and R&D managers. While usability tests and focus groups are useful for specific phases of an app development, they aren't as useful for understanding cultural frameworks and practices because by the time an app is being tested, it already has accumulated so many cultural assumptions and class assumptions along the way in the design process that users are not asked to test something that functions in the programmer's world. It's not the user's world, the programmer's world. So sometimes one size does not fit all. So this is what I wrote back in February 2010. So while most of the blogosphere and news outlets cheered Google on for defying China, I argued that Chinese netizens just didn't find google.cn useful. And I believe Google knew this too. So now that I've had a few months to reflect upon this, I actually don't think any teams of ethnographers, much less engineers, could have saved google.cn. It's contrary to what I had originally suggested. The problem with google.cn is much more deeper than what ethnographers could have solved. Google's difficulties in China were not just a result of their inability to understand the local market or create a recognizable marketing campaign or even to get people to say their name correctly. The real issue was that most fundamentally, Google and China clash over their differing moral paradigms of information. So for the second part of my talk, I make the case that if we want to better understand Google and China, we have to think about the differences in how these two institutions ask the hows and whys of controlling information flows. That lets us understand that Google and China ascribe the two fundamentally conflicting visions about what kind of information should be available to whom, under what conditions, and so on. So in my written work, I talk about normative or prescriptive moral orders and ethical dilemmas of information control. But today, I'll just say that Google and China are two of the largest information filtering institutions in the world. Alice Pasternak has pointed out that they are both after the same thing, information. But it's really not just about information. It's about access to information. Now, China and Google both want to manage information flows, but they have very different visions for how and opposing motivations for why this will be accomplished. This is played out in their moral position, their ideas about what is good and what is bad about providing information. Google exemplifies a hacker ethic that can be traced back to Enlightenment ideals and individual achievement, while China reflects Confucian cultural norms of social harmony that emerged 2,400 years ago during the early Han Dynasty. So let's explore Google's moral order, seeing like a corporation. So Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. Now, their mission is guided by their central motto, "Don't be evil." Is a moral edict that reflects their moral code. There's good, and then there's evil. And so this is real. It is really their motto. So don't be evil isn't just a normative moral judgment on what is evil or good. It's framed as an imperative, a prescriptive order on how to conduct business. This prescriptive order, so just a real quick thing on what's normative and versus prescriptive statement, is a normative statement would be like squeezing bunnies is bad, and a prescriptive one would be like don't squeeze bunnies. So just like don't be evil. So this prescriptive order is reflective of Google's moral stance that more information is good while less information is evil. So making information more transparent and available is good while attempting to obscure or hide it is bad. Now Google's moral order is drawn from a set of guiding principles that have created the very internet technologies that have come out of the West. The set of principles is called the hacker ethic, which emerged around 1960s with the advent of computers at MIT. Now, when I speak of hacker, I do not mean the media creation of a scary hacker who breaks into the CIA, like in this picture. I mean hackers in the traditional sense, who are software engineers who have a shared vision that information should be free and accessible, computers can improve the quality of life, and should be accessible to all. Problems can be solved through direct interaction with the technology or law, and forms of authority are blockers to innovation. So the hacker ethic is actually a revival of the underlying ethical systems that have shaped Western thought since the Enlightenment era of 17th and 18th century Europe. These principles proposed by Kant, Descartes, and Bentham introduce basic notions of individuals as being independently free, educated, and rational beings entering into a contract with society. Now, free individuals were supposed to challenge the state or church. One became human through independent thinking and creative information processing. So with this mistrust of authority, commitment to unfettered information accessibility, and belief that technology would trump all and that individuals would make the rational decision in their choice of search engines, Google went into China thinking that their moral paradigm of do no evil would trump a society with a 2,400-year-old moral order. So let's take a look at China, seeing like a state. China's governing principle rests on the creation of a socially harmonious society. The social harmony doctrine has guided much of China's rulers for generations and was officially endorsed as a doctrine in 2006 by Hu Jintao. The Chinese government drew upon the doctrine as a way to ensure that the contradictions and social costs of economic growth would be ameliorated in the coming years with more attention and more of the budget dedicated to non-economic aspects of society, such as environment, education, or health. Now, it's critical that we try to understand the roots of Chinese concept of socially harmonious society in Confucianism, a 2,400-year-old social practice and state philosophy. Confucianism is very complex, so without going into in-depth discussion, I call our attention to one relevant tenet, but a far-reaching tenet, obedience. Now, Confucianism dictated obedience to higher forms of authority, starting from the king down to government officials, ancestors, elders, parents, and spouses. The doctrine effectively gave each individual a clear role in life. to be a virtuous person. To this end, one became human through compliance, and one became a subject through social acceptance. Social harmony is achieved through an individual's obedience to all forms of higher authority. But in China's moral order, information that serves to prioritize an individual is bad. In Google's moral order, information that serves to prioritize an individual is good. As such, it is understandable why there would be a tension. A moral order rooted in Enlightenment ideals rewards rebels, while a moral order rooted in Confucianism ideals rewards followers. But it's not as simple as saying Google cares about individuals and China doesn't. Both China and Google have accomplished amazing feats for individuals in a short amount of time that is not only historically noteworthy, but revolutionary. China has brought millions out of economic poverty, and Google has brought millions out of information poverty. But at what cost have these measures been delivered? Now, markets have a funny way of bringing odd couples together in the name of profit. Businesses, governments, and individuals that may not ascribe to each other's morals find themselves cooperating and collaborating, each willing to make concessions to reach their end goals. But it appears that Google and China have discovered something that they cannot agree to: access to information. Now, but disagreements are nothing new between institutions, much less between China and the US or China and Google. But what appears to be emerging here is that if there's a fundamental moral difference as understood by Google and China appear to be so vast that they have decided that they are unable to work together in the way that they had originally envisioned. So there's some truth to this. China and Google both want to be ruling gatekeepers of information, yet they both have very different moral orders and form their visions for how this information monopoly will be achieved. Google is emblematic of a new paradigm of capital growth, the generation of wealth through information. This is based on the assumption that any form of culture, experience, and ideas can become digitized into a byte. So, for example, when a physical book is digitized, that means it can be transformed into a digital file where the words are searchable. But here's the thing. Google wants us to believe that despite all the money they make, ultimately they are delivering information that should already be available and accessible. They say that their priority is bringing information freedom and choice to users around the world. But since they are a corporation, their actions are also driven by the search for profit. So unless we reflect on the moral paradigm that drives Google's approach to information, we fail to see how Google benefits as a corporation from an ethical system that prioritizes a free information regime. Now, since Google's project is to turn the whole world into digital bytes of information, they view any efforts against this process as a threat to their business model. So even more so, Google sees any attempt to limit or control the kind of information they provide as evil for two reasons. First, it threatens their profits in advertising-based searching. Google Search is run by its contextual advertising search service, Google AdSense. Businesses that pay for Google AdSense show up as paid links on the right-hand side on Google Search. Every time you click on a paid link, you generate shared revenue for both Google and the business that paid for the link. So, if we search for bunnies and click on the humanesociety.org link on the right-hand side, we just generated income for Google and the Humane Society. Now, while Google offers many other services such as email, translation, maps, blogging, and more, as you can see from this, 97% of Google's 6.7 billion revenue comes from AdSense. So with 90% of their income generation through AdSense, it makes sense why Google would be worried. The second reason why efforts to restrict information can be interpreted as evil is because it calls into question the moral stance that information should be available anytime, anywhere, and to anyone. So then you have China, which has an entirely different set of priorities for information management. With a government focused on social harmony, China's social stance is that too much information could unbalance their country, a country undergoing radical social change. So the bottom line is what counts as information is socially constructed. Google determines what information is good just as much as China does. So for Google, downloading copyrighted songs through the internet is framed as bad information, while in China, this is seen as good. And in China, making government documents available online counts as bad information, while in US, rates as good information. So both Google and China are trying to enact a moral code, which is embodied through their respective control of information availability. So part three. Okay. So some citizens, analysts, politicians, and the Western media cheered Google on for standing up to China and relocating to Hong Kong. Mind you, still a part of China. Now, others thought that the sheer size of the Chinese online market would sway Google to stay in China, much like Microsoft, Yahoo, and others. But I want to highlight one particular analysis. Umar Haig, an economist and director of the Harvard Media Lab, claimed on the Harvard Business Review blog that by leaving China, Google had taken an ethically motivated stance, not an economically motivated stance. In his Awesomeness Manifesto, it is a real manifesto, he asserted that corporations, it's on the Harvard Review blog, so it's real, he asserted that corporations engaged in ethical production are more financially successful and meaningful than those that don't because they innovate in the name of a higher calling, not in the name of profits. So let's consider Umar's proposal on Google's ethical edge. Now, I agree that Google believes that they have an ethical edge. They believe that they draw upon the qualities that stand opposite from evil, benevolence, compassion, and kindness, to serve their higher calling of introducing the world to information. But I absolutely disagree with Umar that this ethical edge is anything new. This is a common moral trope of colonialism, imperialism, globalization, and neoliberalism. Ethical beliefs that justify expansionary practices of extracting commodities and creating new markets in the name of a higher calling. But instead of extracting spices, opium, gold, bodies, labor, or oil, Google was trying to extract information from the Chinese market and then commodify that information as it provided it back to Chinese consumers, ostensibly in the name of freedom. Now, the weapon of choice is no longer guns, germs, and steel, but free information, open platforms, and distributed architectures. And here's the kicker. In leaving China, because the Chinese government wouldn't conform to their rules, Google reproduced the very imperialistic behavior that characterized the greatest imperial powers, leaving a country or region when they couldn't get the natives to abandon their own way of thinking or adopt a new way of behaving. So what's emerging here is a new rhetoric of development and globalization in what I'm calling neo-informationalism, the belief that information should function like currency in free market capitalism, borderless, unregulated, and mobile. The logic of neo-informationalism rests on a moral framework that is tied to what Morgan Ames calls information determinism, the belief that free and open access to information can create positive social change. Now, we should question any ethical system that reproduces a familiar trope of colonialism. Whereas past waves of imperialism use religion, science, or globalization as a rhetoric of development to enlighten the natives, the new rhetoric of neo-informationalism is used as a guiding principle for entering new regions. Ethical principles that can be used as proxies for pushing our belief systems onto other groups. So what does this mean? Do we have to give up Google? No, the world doesn't work in binaries, and neither should you or I. I depend on Google for most of my online communication. I heart Google. Now, I'm known among my friends as a Google evangelist, but while I love the technical aspects of Google's products, I'm at the same time critical of the limits and affordances of its technologies. But herein lies my fear. So what if we start thinking that there is no alternative to the institution of Google? What if the Google model starts to become what we think of as the most natural way to look for information and for information to exist and for social change? We need to make sure that we don't succumb to Googleist realism. Much like capitalist realism, the belief that there is no alternative to the reality of capitalism as a way of life, Googleist realism is the belief that there is no alternative to Google as our search engine and as our gatekeeper of information. The belief that capitalism can improve life is now supplanted by the free information regimes of neo-informationalism, the belief that unfettered information access is life. Now, Google has successfully linked the commodification of information to an ethical system of social change. And this rhetoric is so strong that I worry that we could lose our imagination for any other form of information reality or social change outside of a Google-like model. I also worry that those who question this model will be framed as enemies of freedom, information, and social change. Now, Google and China have their own visions for the social life of information and for the role of information in society. We should be equally critical of a corporation with algorithms that create a consensual consumer culture based on advertising clicks, as we are of a country with policies that create a consensual citizenry based on obedience through a paternalistic form of governance. But we should also be equally hopeful of a corporation with digital applications that creates access to information that was reserved for the privileged, as we are of a country with social policies that empower people to explore their talents and scale their services through a government-supported free market entrepreneurship. So summarizing the 5 points that I've made today. One, as countries create their own internet policies, information politics will become a key site of contestation in a globally networked society. Two, information disjunctures will increasingly fall along moral and ethical disagreements between institutions, reflecting tensions in regional values and beliefs. Three, I also argue that what's at stake in the clashes of moral orders is a determination of meaning. Google isn't just an information processing entity, it's a meaning-making entity. And four, there's a diversity in cultural orientations, and they matter in how technologies are used, received, and created. And when I say technologies, I also include computing technologies. It could also be fire, it could be paper, it could be pencil, or cameras. Now, institutions will continue to make attempts to bound the internet, but in a digitally mediated network society where communication streams and physical contact are more frequent than ever, it becomes harder to maintain silos of communication. The digital mobility of ideas, people, and images means that moral orders are coming into contact with each other. So today I've talked about how beliefs and values are layered onto our technologies and inform our expectations for how they are used. These technologies are never just technical, but they are social, and luckily for us, humanities and social science scholars, they are observable. A few weeks ago, Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple, the company that makes these Apple computers, iPods, iPads, and et cetera, and iPhone, said, quote, "We're not just a tech company, even though we invent some of the highest technology products in the world. It's the marriage of that, plus the humanities and the liberal arts, that distinguishes Apple." So let us be in dialogue with Steve Jobs and Google with some liberal arts magic. We cannot leave this agenda to the technologist. We cannot let the new myths about freedom and information become real, to pass without question. And we must use critical theory, ethnographical methods, and common sense to question how cultural values play out in and around technology. Values not only reproduce contemporary tensions, but they are also sites of contestation. So we have a lot of new questions to ask about social information in this age of neo-informationalism. What role do we want to play in a social agenda that prioritizes ubiquity of free information? And how comfortable are we with this approach when it is part of an imposition of neo-informationalist values in support of capitalism's search for new information markets? So by reflecting on the questions I oppose, my hope is that we can understand the values that shape our technologies and the way we use them, and that we learn to better understand the values that define who we are and how we go about changing the world. So my slides will be posted on Cultural Bytes this weekend, and so will the notes for this talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The garden session with Joyce Appleby is at 1:30 hours. And with Tricia, the garden session is at 3:25 this afternoon. I hope you have a fine day. Take your coffee with you to the talking circle. Thanks a lot. I'm sorry I wasn't on time. I forget that I never activated the Microsoft in my... I run Linux. That's my Microsoft XP, Windows XP partition. I have OpenOffice, which would have...